You're listening to Harris Smith Radio. I'm your host, Wayne McPhail. In this episode, we discover the incredible variety of folks, produce, places, and methods involved in urban gardening in Toronto in a new documentary by Jamie Day Fleck called In My Backyard. Next up, a decades-long waiting game played with hazelnuts, farmers, and science. By the way, if you want to read Harris Smith Magazine instead of listen to it, you can subscribe to the print version online at harrismithmag.com. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on selected newsstands across Canada. But for now, settle in for the next half hour of Harris Smith Radio. Jamie Day Fleck is a documentary filmmaker and an avid backyard and soon-to-be front yard gardener. Her passion for gardening, a well-timed pregnancy, and her filmmaking chops led her to make a fascinating documentary about other folks like her in Toronto who grew plants, well, just about anywhere they could find space. The documentary is called In My Backyard. I spoke with Jamie about her film and the importance of urban gardening for the soul and the planet. Here's our conversation. Hey, Jamie, thanks very much for joining us. A while back on the podcast, I interviewed Suzanne Crocker, who did a wonderful documentary about First Weed, about living in Dawson City and just feeding her family from the 100 miles around her, which was quite a challenge. And in her case, she's a doctor who learned how to make a documentary. In your case, you're a documentary filmmaker who decided to grow a backyard garden and then make a documentary about the backyard garden. So it's a bit different. So how did you come about giving your interest in documentaries to make a documentary about the garden that you were about to build?
As a documentary filmmaker, I tend to just allow the next project to sort of present itself to me. And I was in the process of wrapping up a feature documentary about a classical music composer. And I actually got pregnant with my second child, and she was part of the editing process as a newborn. And at the same time that was occurring, we installed one bed in the backyard and started to plant vegetables into it. We got a company called Backyard Urban Farm Company, who's in the film, and they came and put all kinds of seedlings and different things that we probably wouldn't have planted into this small, I considered it small compared to the rest of our backyard, but compared to other city gardens, it might have been a large plot. And we got lots of veggies out of that. And it sort of inspired me to see what was possible. And my husband comes from a farming community in Quebec. And so he was very used to his mother keeping gardens, his sister's garden. So it wasn't very foreign to him. And he's also in the trades. So he started building beds. And the next year we expanded into three beds. The next year I was so involved in the research of how to garden and what to grow. And I was reading books and I was learning about nutrition. And I had my own health issues that I was working through, and obviously feeding young children. So it just became a natural progression to do more and see what was possible. And my husband also got into beekeeping. So that was another thing that pushed forward this whole journey. And I was so obsessed with it that I just thought researching a totally different project right now would not be very viable for me, particularly with two young children. So I just thought this is the next project.
And in the course of the documentary, you talk to people who are growing gardens in their backyard, in their front yard, on their roofs, on the top of apartment buildings, in allotment gardens, in cooperative allotment gardens, they're growing orchards, they're harvesting fruit from other people's trees. Were you surprised as you started researching the diversity of urban garden that you came across?
I was surprised by the diversity of what people were doing. I was inspired by the diversity. I knew there was a lot going on because I was researching the topic, and also because I was part of the Toronto Gardeners Facebook page, where I got to see a lot of people were just posting their gardens, and I saw rooftops and I saw condo developments and I saw all these different things. So I put out an open call on Toronto Gardeners to see if anyone was interested in being part of the documentary. I also pursued people that I thought had a particular setup that would work really well for the film. I wanted to show a diversity. I wanted to show all the possibilities within one city. And by looking at my city I'm saying this is probably happening in your city and you should find where are your community gardens, where are your urban farms, where are your farmers markets, all these kinds of things.
I really appreciated the range, the breadth of people that you talked to. One of the guys that I wanted to talk about particularly was Isaac Crosby, who works with the Evergreen Brickworks and the garden that he's got there. And one of the things that he talked about, and I saw it echoed in other people's commentary about gardens, is they weren't just simply looking at gardens as a way of growing good food, but as a way of connecting with a community of, as he said, that if you don't know how to grow your own food, you're letting somebody take away your power. That kind of broader purpose for a garden, I saw echoed through and through. Can you talk a little bit, starting with maybe with Isaac, about that notion of people finding purpose in the garden that goes beyond simply the utilitarian eating of the food that they grow?
Absolutely. I mean, this is definitely part of my own journey as well in backyard gardening. Growing food is so much more beneficial than just the food, particularly now where we're so disconnected from where our food is coming from. And when you really connect to where your food is coming from, I feel like all those big issues that we're talking about climate change, we're talking about polluting the environment, we're talking about our health, connecting with nature, our past even, and how our ancestors were able to survive, all these things come into view when you start to grow your own food.
So let's talk about that role that gardening plays. Particularly, let's start with the personal, because you talked to Maria Solakowski, and she was a gardener that really impressed me in terms of speaking about how a garden lets her connect with her rhythm and allows her to give her gift to the community. So that's a very personal, deep connection that she has with a garden. So let's start there and talk about what you heard from people who see gardening as a way of anchoring themselves and finding joy in life through their garden, and how that manifests itself around them in the way they connect with the community.
Right. Maria's garden is amazing. She's actually connected with people who are interested in learning about urban homesteading. And she's got basically a team of interns that are now, or volunteers that are working her garden because they want to learn all of the various things she has to teach. So she has really created community with that garden, and she has a long history of doing that. So her real impetus is education, not just growing the food, but also educating people in this. And she has a very diverse amount of education and herbs and tea making and various cooking techniques. So her garden was really inspirational. I love the really round organic forms and utilizing a lot of found materials in her garden.
So you also talked to, just thinking of educators, you talked to Steve Briggs and his daughter, Emma, I think, right? So tell me a little bit about Steve's approach to gardening and more importantly, I guess, Steve's approach to educating young people about gardening.
Stephen Biggs is a very important gardening educator in Canada, really, but in Toronto. He works at two schools, and he also has several books that he's written and has a podcast. So he has a great depth of knowledge and shares it quite freely with the community. His daughter has also published a book for kids to garden, and they do a lot of seminars and workshops. I learned so much just seeing their garden and seeing the diversity of what they're doing there. There's really a lot of different systems that are at work there, like sub-irrigated planters, their straw bale garden, their tomato experimentation, their variety of plants like figs, lemons, and pawpaw trees. So he is really pushing the boundaries of what can be grown in Toronto and sharing that with others.
Yeah, I was amazed to see he's growing olives, right? Like he's experimenting with growing olives. Let's talk a little bit about not just the diversity of people that were in the documentary, but the diversity of food. Because one of the things that I saw in the documentary were folks coming together from different cultures and learning from each other about how to grow different varieties of food. So, you know, to go back to Isaac Crosby, he was growing a lot of indigenous plants. We've got Steve trying to grow figs. Can you talk a little bit about the diversity of food that you saw being grown in urban gardens in Toronto?
The diversity of things that are being grown and the ethnicities that were featured were very, it was very important to me to show that in the film, because there are a lot of different cultures in Toronto. If you talk to most people, they're going to say it's a multicultural city, and that's something they appreciate about it. Also, people that come from other places, they bring their foods with them, and being able to grow those things here in Toronto helps them to connect back with where they're from. So I think that's very important. I love the discussion around food and how you can introduce people to all different kinds of flavors through growing different things in the garden. So yes, Isaac Crosby was wonderful. I mean, he's not from another country, he's from here, but his indigenous growing techniques that he's doing down at Thrive Garden is very important that we do know about those things as Canadians, because these are native plants to where we live and our ancestral foods. And we should appreciate those things. Also, indigenous growing techniques are helpful in reducing water usage because the plants are adapted to our environment. It's also, they have ways of handling the soil and the land that's very valuable to all gardeners.
Now, and he does a lot of education in the garden for kids. And you also visited another school or another educational area, Gledhill Public School, in the documentary. What did you learn from what they're teaching kids about gardening there?
School gardens are something that are cropping up in a lot of places. I wanted to feature those so that we could show how you could actively integrate gardening into a school curriculum. The teacher that was there had an eco club. She also utilized it in her science classes. Gardening is a life skill and something that we should definitely be teaching young people, particularly edible gardening, so that they are more self-sufficient and they are able to connect with nature and the land and to be able to grow their own food and connect with their food. And it's also better for their health. Kids that grow food are more likely to eat that food and therefore eat more healthy vegetables. So I think it's a wonderful thing to integrate into schools, even something small, like a couple planters, like were there.
As you said, it's quite a small garden. But I want to talk about big gardens that were also in the documentary. And I'm thinking about Fresh City. So can you explain for folks who don't know what Fresh City is or how they develop as a big urban garden in Toronto, what exactly it is and how it relates to other businesses that have started up there?
So Fresh City Farms is an innovative, revolutionary idea in the sense that it is a full for-profit working farm within a city. It's actually the largest working urban farm in Canada, and they're about to expand into a larger space next year. The other thing that is innovative about that space is they rent out plots to other urban farmers so that there's other businesses that are operating on the same property. This is fantastic. I mean, I used to bring my kids there for U-pick days. You could actually go to the farm and pick your own vegetables, and they had workshops at the farm. So it's both an educational site and a business.
So I want to talk a little bit about the business aspect of urban farming, because one of the things that struck me in the documentary was that sort of business ecosystem that's grown up around urban farming. And I'm thinking about the guy that's making the compost tea, for example. Can you talk a little bit about how a city like Toronto that has urban gardening has actually built up to a point where you can actually build a supportable infrastructure for urban gardening?
Yes, that's a very good question. And this was a major facet of the film that I wanted to cover, which is that in order for us to move ahead, we actually have to and be more sustainable in our lives or to mitigate climate change. We actually have to change the way we're doing business. And so I wanted to highlight businesses in the film that are working in innovative ways to bring food closer to the people that are going to use it. And then there's all the subsidiary businesses which could assist in that process, like compost tea or compost facilities or delivery services or edible gardening landscaping services. So those are in the film too. Obviously, we have urban farmers, but there's a lot of other business surrounding that, even farm-to-table restaurants, which aren't in the film, but could be another subsidiary business. So I think what I really wanted to show in the film is innovation. We have a economic system that is like this, but there are people that are thinking out of the box and coming up with new ways and new solutions to how to feed people. And it, while it's being done small scale now, these are things that could be scaled up. And if they were implemented in all cities, we would see the effects in a large way.
And you also touched on some nonprofits and activism surrounding urban farming, particularly around food security. And I'm thinking of, first of all, Not Far From the Tree, which is this really cool project where folks harvest fruit from trees in people's backyards who can no longer harvest them because they got a giant apple tree and they're, you know, 92 years old and they can't harvest the fruit anymore. Can you talk a little bit about that particular nonprofit and how that fits into the landscape of urban gardening?
I mean, food waste is a huge issue right now, but we often don't think about fruit trees, because when we just let that crop of fruits drop on the ground and they rot, we are wasting food. And there's so much food in Toronto that could be harvested and utilized and given or donated to people that can use it, or even for the families that own the tree. So I think Not Far From the Tree is a wonderful initiative where they give a third of the harvest to the volunteers, a third to the homeowner, and a third to an organization that can use it, like a food bank or some other organization that can process that fruit.
One of the activists you've spoken to, Paul Taylor, he said something that I wanted to get your feedback on. He said, our federal government isn't obliged to give out free food, but they are obliged to create conditions to allow people to access the food that they need. So how does urban gardening fit with that and help with that?
You know, that goes right in with the fruit tree. What we were just talking about, the fruit trees. You know, I live in a neighborhood where there are an abundance of apple trees, and yet often people don't want to share, or they don't even think to harvest them. So this is an example of free food. It's actually just growing there, and we should take advantage of it. So I think urban gardening could be a massive force in bringing food closer to people that need it, and actually producing a substantial amount of food right within the cities. Look at our parks. Look at the amount of space. That's what really is highlighted in the film, is utilization of urban space. We always think about urban space as being development possibility. But what about these spaces that are being underutilized, like rooftops, parking lots, parks, where it's just a big swath of grass and nobody really uses it except maybe to let their dog run around? These are spaces within cities that we actually could be growing food that could be utilized and eaten by the people in that community.
After you finished the documentary, and you know it was spawned by your interest in having a backyard garden, how did you rethink, or did you rethink, how you grow food in your backyard? Or maybe you're thinking of moving into your front yard as well, like some people did. How did doing the documentary change you as a gardener?
Well, I got so inspired. It really pushed me to do the whole backyard, first of all, because when we started out with the garden, we were thinking it was a part of it, but the rest would be a family space in the sense of relaxing or whatever. But it turned into the entire backyard. I was more inspired to try things and be more adventurous with what I was putting in there. Like, we've grown sweet potatoes, we've added asparagus, we're looking now at putting in fruit trees and berry bushes, and we now have a small fig tree, just like Steven, so that we're working on. I even found a neighbor that has many, many fig trees. So it's allowed me to talk more with the gardening community in Toronto and be inspired by them, and then implement those ideas. We are actually moving into the front yard too. That's the plan for next year. So There's always ways to expand. There's even the roof over our garage. So I think doing this film has really opened my mind to the possibilities. I've also started looking at fruit trees in my neighborhood and seeing if I can maybe connect with the homeowners to see how we can harvest these trees instead of letting it all go to waste. And that's something I want to work on. And I've done a lot of education with the community I've done garden tours in the back. I've answered a lot of questions. I started a seed library. We give away seedlings in the spring. So many different initiatives to try to get the community more involved with growing food as well.
And how do you hope people will be changed from watching your documentary?
I really hope people will be inspired to try growing something, whether it's even just a couple pots of herbs on their balcony. And maybe they don't have growing space, but at least they will think about, where is my food coming from? How is it being grown? Because, you know, when I put in that first garden, the idea of throwing poisons onto it was ridiculous. I would never think to do that. This is food that my children are going to eat.
Well, thank you very much for doing the documentary, and I hope it does inspire people to grow stuff. And thank you for spending the time with us today.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm so grateful that Harrow Smith is helping with this film.
That was Jamie Day Fleck, who spoke with me from her home in Toronto. Grimo Nut Nurseries pioneered growing nut trees in Ontario almost 50 years ago. One of the species they produce is the hazel tree. I spoke with Linda Grimo, the farm manager, about a fascinating story of foresight and patience that has to do with hazelnuts and Nutella. Here's our conversation. So Linda, thanks very much for joining us. I want to talk about your tree nursery. I know you grow a wide variety of fruit trees and nut trees and have everything associated with nuts there. But I want to talk specifically about hazelnuts. Now, your dad started this nursery almost 50 years ago now, right?
Yeah, that's correct, in 1972.
So what made him interested in growing nut trees, particularly in Ontario?
He knew that nut trees grew in Ontario, but it was not well known what could be grown. People had them in woodlots, the trees grew in forests, but people didn't realize that they could grow nut trees in their backyards and commercially in Ontario. So he really pioneered that thought.
So let's talk specifically about the hazelnuts that you grow. One of the interesting things about them is, I guess it's in Brantford since about 2006, Ferrero makes Ferrero Rocher chocolates with the hazelnuts in them, has been a big part of the hazelnut industry in Ontario. Can you talk about your relationship with Ferrero and what happened there?
Yeah, Ferrero was a driving force to help with a lot of the research that has been done in Ontario since the plant was built in 2006. Almost immediately, they joined up with researchers from the University of Guelph, and eventually the board of the Ontario Hazelnut Association was formed. And they worked together with the association to research to see, you can grow hazels all over the world. So we had to show to Ferrero what can and cannot be grown in Ontario in terms of hazelnuts.
So what I find interesting about the Ferrero relationship is, as I understand it, it's not going to be for another decade before Ontario farmers who have hazel trees are going to be able to contribute to the making of chocolate and the Ferrero Rocher chocolates and other stuff that Ferrero does, because the volume just isn't there, that Ferrero needs so much hazelnuts. Is that right?
That's correct. Right now, there is no production going to Ferrero from Ontario. They require huge, if you can imagine, container loads of hazels to create a batch of Nutella. And they require more than is produced at this point. So they probably, in reality, won't be able to purchase from Ontario farmers for about 10 years. They knew it was a long-term plan and that it took a big vision to create this plan of action. But the growers in Ontario are supplying chefs and restaurants and other confectioners that are also making chocolate hazelnut spreads and other chocolate hazelnut creations. So there's no shortage of creation and creativity in Ontario.
So I just find that fascinating that it's just been such a long haul to get, you know, and it's still a decade away before we get any production into that plant. So for farmers who want to grow hazelnuts, I looked at a map that you have on your site, and it looks like the optimal growing areas sort of hug the shore of the lower Great Lakes. Is that right?
Along the Lake Ontario and Lake Erie, especially closer to the lake, provides a bit of protection for the trees. Hazelnuts can be grown inland as well and in colder zones, but the ones that Ferrero wants are grown specifically around, like you said, hugging the lake. They're just not as hardy.
Are you seeing an increase in interest in the hazel tree production? Who's coming to your nursery to get the trees these days?
So we have actually an 18-month wait list because the trees that produce the most are in high demand, and we just can't produce them fast enough. We have partnered with another nursery who's creating trees for us, as well as three labs to create tissue-cultured plants. The lab work is unfortunately very slow, and it takes time because if you can imagine taking cells and dividing them until you create a plant out of that, that roots, it's a fascinating aspect of plant propagation, but it's, each tree has its own kind of recipe or formula, so it takes quite a bit of time. Once the formula or the recipe is figured out, they can mass produce hazelnuts. They can make a million trees in a year. It's just getting that formula right. So that's the backlog. But we've got people from cold zones and temperate zones in Ontario and customers in the U.S. lining up and waiting for their trees to be produced.
Why is there such a waiting list? Like, why is there such a demand for hazelnuts?
Because it's a fantastic crop to grow. Growing trees for nuts is, I don't want to say it's easy, but when someone has gone from a tender fruit crop like peaches or pears or any of that such, there's a lot of work. There's a lot of spraying. There's a lot of manual harvesting. These nut crops don't have that. One person alone can manage 10 acres. You can't do that in a peach orchard. For a lot of people looking at how to retire into something that they can do for the next 20 years, hazelnut growing is very appealing. Another aspect or another set of growers are those who are cash croppers and they have well-drained soil. They're in an ideal location. They make almost nothing, hit or miss, off their cash crops. But growing a tree crop is something they can do and use their land mass for, even to diversify their farm income. And they can make substantially more, a little different way of thinking and growing a product.
Thanks very much for sharing about the nursery. And I just find it fascinating that people really, in order to raise hazelnut trees and benefit from hazelnut trees, it seems like what you're saying is people have to not put in a lot of work, but they have to have a lot of patience in terms of waiting to get the trees and then get the results for Ferraro, for example.
Yeah, it is a bit of a waiting game, but we find that people are just so excited and they're willing to take that time because hazelnut trees, while it may take a couple years to produce, they're going to produce for 50 to 100 years.
That was the very patient Linda Grimaud of Grimaud Nut Nurseries just outside Niagara-on-the-Lake. So, here we are at the end of this episode of Harris Smith Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please consider subscribing to this podcast at Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast player. And please, tell your friends and family. Got feedback? We'd love to hear it. You can email us at letters@harrismithmag.com. That URL, harrismithmag.com, is also where you can order subscriptions online. And you can find Harris Smith Magazine on newsstands of selected stores across Canada. Until next time, for Harris Smith Radio, I'm Wayne McPhail. And also, until next time, remember these four words: make, grow, sustain, share. Tune in for the next episode of Harris Smith Radio.